Okay, so thanks for having me. Thanks for coming in this morning. And so I'll talk about non-Markovian quantum phenomena, and the title says a complete language, which is probably a lie. What we have is the alphabet. Words are still missing, so we're far away from language. What you ultimately want is slang, right? You want to be able to very quickly say something and communicate effectively. So, okay, so I lied already, but I think we're getting there. And the applications are vast of non-Markovian processes, right? It applies to chemistry, also I should add biology, but biology starts with B, so I didn't want to add it to this list because it's very nice. But quantum computers, issues of causality will come up, and complexity. So speaking of language, a lot of us speak very different languages, and a lot of what I'll talk about you may not be familiar with, so just, you know, I don't really care if I get to only slide 5, so I'm happy to go to the board and explain what I mean. So we can make this pretty informal. Okay, so typically I start with this little cartoon, which is a very good example of what a stochastic process is: traffic. It's, if you have a city and various roads are connected to each other, if there's an accident in one place, it's going to impact traffic in other place, and you can think of that as a stochastic process.
Is there a deeper meaning that they're driving on the left-hand side?
I do come from Australia. So.
Always the correct side, right?
It's the correct side. Not the right side, but the correct side. But I actually didn't pick up on that, so thank you for pointing that out. Another good one is the stock market. So let's say you have value of a stock. It starts here, and then you might predict that it might take two different trajectories going into the future. And you might associate some probabilities with these events. So you might say that, well, the probability of trajectory with blue dots is something, and the probability for trajectory with red dots is something else. And that actually, the probability of these trajectories, all the possible trajectories this stock can take, is a stochastic process. It's a joint probability distribution of events in time. Okay. And this is kind of crucial. And a important distinction that people often make is Markovian and non-Markovian. And roughly what it means, well, it means this exactly, that suppose we are at this point and we want to know whether the stock will go that way or that way tomorrow, whether it's going to go up or down, do we need to know the value of the stock for the last week, or do we just need to know what the current value is? Right? And if we need to know the past, then it's non-Markovian. In other words, if we were on the trajectory with blue dots, the future probabilities will be different than if we were on a trajectory with red dots. And so if these two things are not equal, then this is a non-Markovian process. And of course, a Markovian process is you only care about where you are. You only care about the current price and nothing else. Now, this is vastly simpler than this, right? Because there you need a lot more information, and you have to process a lot more information. You have to know what happened in the past. And in fact, people who can process process this information, make more money. Traders, in fact, do make use of this kind of information. Now, note that this joint probability distribution has more information than a master equation, which is often the language that we like to use when we talk about stochastic processes. Master equations are really nice. Physicists like it because you can write down a differential equation or a difference equation, so there's something very appealing about it. However, a master equation is relating how the future will look like, knowing something about the present and the rate of change. So it's got some information about the past, but not a whole lot. And this is something that I think we're still working through. So why do we actually care about? I mean, obviously we care about these histories in this particular example, but are there other examples where we care about that? So one of the things that we're working on is looking at neural data from a fly. So here's a fly. I think these are the eyes. And this is a fly's brain. And a probe is stuck into it. There are 15 channels. And you get voltage reading on each channel, which can then be binarized. And knowing these zeros and the time series data of zeros and ones, you can construct the simplest Markovian model for this firing pattern. And in fact, so we've done that. So these are Markov chains representing the same fly, but under two different conditions. The fly was anesthetized here, and the fly was awake in this case. And you can tell the difference. So this information comes from multi-time correlations. And it clearly tells us something about whether the fly was drugged or not. It doesn't always work, of course. I mean, it is biology. So nothing quantum here so far. So let's go to something quantum. So a good example of a quantum process, well, this is still somewhat classical, is the blinking of quantum dots. So suppose we have a bunch of quantum dots, they're going on and off, and can we describe that process? The information is still somewhat classical, but the underlying system is quantum. But we could have something a bit more quantum, say, for instance, a chemical reaction. We might want to do something, study the rate of chemical reaction. Maybe we want to alter it. Maybe we want to shine some light here and change the way this reaction goes. Another example is, and this is, I think, the big buzz in the field, a quantum computer. In a quantum computer, we're applying sequence of gates, in this case, on a single qubit. This is the IBM's 5-qubit quantum computer, and we did this experiment. And often, when we apply these gates, we have some errors. And we often assume that these errors are independent. And instead of applying gates U and V, we wind up applying some maps, some completely positive maps. This is probably one of those terms that maybe not everyone's familiar with, so I'm happy to go through with it on the chalkboard if need be. But so we can describe this process in terms of some matrices, effectively, products of matrices. But it could also turn out that the environment, so as we're applying gates on our system, the environment sticks around and generates correlations between gates U and V. And so I wouldn't say real experiment, but this is a remote experiment that we did on the IBM system. And we show, not just in this way, but we show in various different ways that this machine indeed has correlations in between sequence of gates. So you apply a gate and then you apply another gate. The performance of that second gate is different condition on which gate came before it. This could be problematic. Now, another good example of a non-Markovian quantum system is something that Susanna talked about yesterday, that we might have a biological complex that potentially has some quantum mechanical features, or maybe it's not quantum, maybe it's classical, it doesn't matter. But let's say that this is the system of interest, which is attached to some big molecule or some other big thing, and we want to study the dynamics here. One thing we could do is we could strip this off and study it in isolation, but then it's a completely different object, so we shouldn't do that if we want to say know something about the properties. But what we can do is to shine light on it and see how it reacts. And by shining pulses of lights, we can say something about the internal dynamics. This is 2D spectroscopy. And 2D spectroscopy really is accounting for multi-time correlations in a quantum system. Okay, so these are some very good problems, and now I want to start with some motivations for why I want to study this. So I'll list a few things, and hopefully I'll get to a couple of these by end of my time. So first thing I want to point out is that usually when we talk about quantum stochastic processes, we talk about master equations, or some people talk about master equations, other people like talking about completely positive maps, or the quantum generalization of stochastic maps or stochastic matrices. And it'd be good to know what is the relationship between the two. Are the two ways of describing a stochastic process equivalent? How do you go between the two? So that's sort of maybe a technical problem, that can we merge these two different ways of talking about stochastic process. Another question could be, can we talk about multi-time correlations in a quantum system in some natural way? So we have some quantum system that's undergoing some open dynamics, and we do something to that system. Let's say we measure it over and over and over. Can we write down the joint correlation of these measurements? Now, those are sort of mechanistic questions, but something more practical would be, can we develop new approximation methods and new techniques to make this dynamics more tractable? And I want to be able to do that on a classical computer or a quantum computer. So whether it's quantum simulation of an open stochastic, open quantum process, or if you're classically simulating a stochastic process. And I mean, this is what I'm really interested in, the logical structure of quantum stochastic processes, logical and causal structure. And can we make that more transparent? And I'll say more about that in a bit. And then there are some interesting foundational questions, like fast Markovianization. And the way I like to think about it, this is something I heard when I was a graduate student, somebody saying that all carbon atoms are the same, which is kind of remarkable, that if you take a carbon atom, how come it doesn't remember whether it belonged to carbon monoxide yesterday or carbon dioxide? How does it forget so quickly? Maybe it doesn't even have to be a day, it could be a few seconds. So how does Markovianization happen? And this is some analog of thermalization. How do systems thermalize quickly? And that, I think that's a really interesting problem that hasn't been looked at in quantum or classical literature, as far as I know. Okay, so what is the problem for quantum stochastic processes? So generally when we quantize things, at least in quantum information theory, what you do is you start with a theory that has some probabilities in it, and you turn those probabilities into a density matrix. And that seems to work. So this is a more general object than this, but this is the way we do the quantizing. So this, of course, works. So suppose we have three coins and a joint probability distribution for three coins. Then we can turn that into three quantum coins or qubits and write down a joint density matrix or a joint wave function for these three objects. Can we do that in time? So a few slides ago, I said that a classical stochastic process is the joint probability distribution of a random variable in time. So it could be the weather over 3 days. What's the probability of having three sunny days? Probably pretty high in Santa Barbara. What's the probability of having three sunny days in Melbourne? Practically zero. We're always going to get some rain. So this is the same object, but in time. Can we write down a density matrix for the same object in time, but a joint density matrix? So I don't want the density matrix at time t1 and another density matrix at t2. I want a density matrix for t1 and t2 and 3 and so on. I think that's sort of the mathematical challenge facing us. Practically, we have this following scenario. Let's imagine that this is our wave function, and it's going to have some time evolution. Now, what happens is that after some time, the wave function is something, but you don't know what it is in the lab or in a computer experiment. So if you want to learn some information about it, you're going to make a measurement on it. So you make a measurement, and you get a particular outcome. And then evolution continues. Now, this future evolution is influenced not only by what you started with, but also by the measurement process, the choice of the measurement operator and the outcome. So how do you separate, how can you talk about the future independent of what happened in the middle? Now this is something that doesn't happen in classical domain. So in a classical domain, a stochastic process is something that the scientist is sitting back and observing, but you're allowed to observe without disturbing, right? So you don't actually go and meddle with the system. So let's imagine that we're sitting here daydreaming, looking out the window and watching birds fly by the window, and we can draw trajectories that the birds will take, and the probability for a particular trajectory can be also estimated. Well, we're not interfering with birds. But if the birds are quantum mechanical objects, then we can't see them fly through. We have to interfere with them to measure. So that's roughly the challenge. In other words, the challenge is the following. There are two words there. Can you tell me what the two words are? What are the chances? So last two talks, somebody also got that. But previous to that, for the last two years, no one's gotten that. So something's changed. Yes, process and control. So what I mean by that is process is something that the universe is doing to our system, and control is what we exercise on the system. And in quantum mechanics, the two get mixed together. And we'd like to be able to separate out. We want to talk about the process on its own without any reference to the control. And we want to be able to talk about, we can choose control arbitrarily. That's not all that mysterious, right? A quantum state is fully described by a density matrix. Right? It doesn't depend on the choice of measurement. What you can get is the probability for observing a particular outcome when you choose a measurement given a quantum state. So that's a similar analogy. In fact, that analogy holds exactly, as I'll show in a couple of slides. So in other words, what we would like is for a choice of control parameters, we'd like to have some descriptor for the process so that we can make a mapping by contracting the two and giving us probabilities or quantum states going into the future. And this is doable. And here's how it goes. It's quite simple in some ways. So this is a quantum circuit for my open dynamics. So this top line represents environment, bottom line represents system, and time is going from left to right. So I start with some joint state of the system and the environment, and I have some unitary dynamics for the system and the environment together. It doesn't have to be unitary, but let it be unitary for now. And then along the way, the experimentalist, or which could be me, is making some interventions on the system, making some operations on the system. Those can be whatever. They can be measurements, they can be unitary operations, or physically they could be laser pulses, RF pulses, or whatever. It doesn't matter. So you have the system and the environment that are undergoing some dynamics, and we're trying to learn something about the system as this is happening. So we can imagine this line to be our quantum computer. This could be our stray environment, some electrons sitting around, or maybe a classical field sitting around, and the two are interacting with each other. And we're applying unitary gates on our system, and then later on we're going to make a measurement. So how do we separate the process from the control? So what we do is we draw a red line around everything that we don't know, everything that we don't control, that is some initially correlated state of the system in the environment and the joint dynamics. And that thing is nothing more than a tensor. And we can call that tensor by this curly T. And the thing down here, these operations, are also a tensor. And it turns out that you can just define a mapping from this tensor acting on this tensor, giving us the output state. And that's roughly the proof of constructing this object. So we have separated the process, which is here, from the control. We call it the process tensor, and it's a mapping from control operations to states.
Why do you call it? It's not enough to say a superoperator?
It is, it's a little bit more than a superoperator, because the representation, mathematical representation for these is CP maps. So those themselves are superoperators. So it's an operator on superoperators.
That's what you mean by a tensor.
Sorry? Yeah.
That's what you mean by a tensor.
Yeah. Yeah, and this is also called a quantum comb, because it looks like a comb, and which is a mapping on a family of super operators to something else. Yeah.
So the way that how you write it is that your coupling to the environment happens also in a stroboscopic way. Is this a restriction for what you want to do?
No. It is and it isn't. It is and it isn't. So I'll talk about that in a second. So in fact, this happens classically as well. So if you have a multi-time correlation or multi-time distribution, that's also somewhat stroboscopic. But you can choose your T1, T2, T3 to be variables. But if you vary them, you get different distributions. Right? You get a family of distributions. It's like a family of completely positive maps. If you write down a family of completely positive maps from 0 to t, they're independent of each other for every value of t. So, okay, so how good is this? Well, we can prove that it's universal. And the way we prove that is that you can take any quantum open quantum evolution and map that to a process tensor, and vice versa. This object can then be shown to be a linear and it's a multilinear, completely positive map. So if you don't know what that means, don't worry about it. It's not terribly important, but it's kind of a nice property to have mathematically. And like I said before, that it sort of resembles a density matrix. That analogy turns out to be exactly true. The reference for that is not this, it's another paper by a colleague, but I forgot to put it on, by Fabio Costa and Charlie Shrapnel, and maybe Jared Milburn as well, I can't remember. Anyway, so what it says is that you have this description for the process tensor, which is the stuff in the purple box up top, and you have a set of control operations where you might have a local quantum memory as well. And that also is a comb. So both of these objects are combs, and we just have two combs plugging into each other. And the probability of observing a sequence of events that are denoted by these letters A0, A1, all the way up to AK, is given by taking these two tensors, which are just big matrices, multiplying them in a particular way, and taking the trace over it. So this is nothing more than the Born rule, but Born rule in space and time. So this is a spatial-temporal object, this is a spatial-temporal object, and this is just telling us that a sequence of events, we can think of this as a measurement operator, and we can think of this as a density matrix. So I'm almost out of time, but I'll try to get to it. So,
Kava, one question. Is it true that the linearity will be enforced because you could find instances also when you go to the standard setup for applying Born rule, even for expectation values? So, or in other words, should you end up with some non-linear comb, will this automatically imply conflicts with Born rule, or is not that direct?
So linearity is always guaranteed in these things. So I'm not quite sure how one might get a non-linear comb. There is actually a way of getting that, but one can always avoid that. So if you separate the external agent who's doing the experiments from the process, then this can always be done in this way. You just might have to go to bigger and bigger dilations. That's also not entirely true, but I mean, do note that this object, when you write down this tensor, it's independent of size of the environment. It only depends on the system, and you can do tomography on it, and you can do local tomography and determine it by only measuring the system.
Come on, is it also true for continuous variable systems? There is only
yes.
Finite dimensions.
It should. No, it's also true for.
Yeah,
of course, with continuous variable, you have to be much more careful, but it's true, and I'll show why it's true. This turns out to, there's this thing called causal modeling in classical theory, which is sort of a superset of stochastic processes. Stochastic processes gives you probability distributions, and it gives you correlations between events. But causal modeling can actually differentiate between cause and effect. So you can say that this event implies this other event, and not vice versa. And this framework turns out to be causal modeling for quantum systems. So imagine that you have a quantum network. Time is going this way. These are different objects, and they're influencing each other in a particular way. And you can take any shaded region and construct a process tensor on that and determine all causal relationship within that shaded region. So, and so what's interesting is that classically stochastic processes and causal modeling are not equivalent, but quantum mechanically they are the same. And that has to do with the fact that you don't have a choice but to intervene onto the system when you're doing a quantum experiment. Classically, you can sit back and watch and observe a stochastic process. I'll skip that. So I want to go back to my questions, since I'm almost out of time. So I think I've answered at least two of these questions. So we can talk about multi-time correlations in terms of quantum maps. And we can write down and understand the causal structure. Now, it turns out...
Could I ask a question?
Sure.
Some while ago, we had a slightly, what I think might be a slightly different take but on, let's say, non-Markovian dynamics. But somehow I also have the feeling that somehow it must be in there. And what we said was we wanted to make a connection to many body systems or to matrix processes.
Yeah.
So we basically said, okay, we prepare some matrix product state somehow. And then we take our system and we allow it to interact with the first particle. Then we allow it to interact with the second particle and with the third one. And of course,
yeah,
the interactions are local, but the correlations are encoded in,
yes,
the kind of many-body correlations that,
yep,
we have. So is this the same, or is this when your measurement interventions are on identities, or
it's a subcase. So in that instance, what happens is you have a common cause. So in fact, the system will undergo non-Markovian dynamics, but because it's interacting with one part of a correlated environment, one at a time, the source of that correlation is entirely in the initial correlations of the environment. So that's called common cause.
That's right.
But there are other mechanisms for having different causes.
Is that really different in this comp? I mean, once you have written down the comp, I mean...
It is different, actually. It would take a little bit of detail to show, but... But I'm aware... This is paper with Romani, right?
That's right, yeah.
I'm aware of it, but I don't think I actually understood the connection till very recently, so I'd love to chat about it. So it turns out that a lot of these things were already done back when I was a baby. In the quantum probability literature, and even before that. So quantum probability literature comes from this paper by Accardi, Fregario, and Lewis in 82, but even before that, Lindblad had written down this exact object in 79, and the paper's been more or less ignored, interestingly. But it's and possibly this paper also does something similar, but I never quite understood it. Accardi's papers are impossible to read, I find. And I think that trend continues in quantum probability literature. But I think this different language is timely and can be useful. I'll skip that. There are lots of other people who have rediscovered this. Here's a list. It's recorded, so you can go back to it. And one of the... things that you can do is that this quantum comb can be proven to be an MPO, and I think that's a different MPO than the one you're referring to, but it can, so it looks just like a density matrix, and so the tools of tensor network can be useful in addressing non-Markovian correlations and non-Markovian dynamics. You can apply proper contractions and so on, and that's not the language quantum probability uses. So potentially there is an advantage here the different way of looking at it. I'll skip that, and I'll skip that. But you can resolve the issue of what is a Markov process in an unambiguous way, but I won't talk about that. But what is, I think, quite interesting is the idea of Markov order. Classically, what Markov order says is that if I have Markov order of 5, in order for me to predict the future, I don't need to look back further than last 5 events. And this is, of course, also going to be true in quantum mechanics, except it's a little bit tricky. It becomes instrument dependent. It depends on what observable you apply. But there is an approximate Markov order that comes into most processes as long as there is some dissipation. And that could be really useful in predicting future dynamics, predicting long-term dynamics from short-term information. And I guess maybe I'll just stop there because I'm out of time. Is that right? I won't get to this Markovinization, but we have a paper on this, and that's just accepted in quantum yesterday. And I won't get to this either. That was also a paper in quantum accepted last year, so quantum doesn't get any publicity. So these are the results, but I can talk about them later. Funding, blah, blah, blah. And thank you very much.
Sorry, I'm always directly behind you. So it seems like the natural interface between this work and the subject of this particular program would be the Lieb-Robinson bounds,
mm-hmm.
and how those can be influenced by your notions of generalized notions of causality in open quantum systems. Have you thought about that and trying to test those in quantum simulators and specific predictions? You know, for different kinds of interactions, like with Rydberg simulators, we can engineer so many different kinds of interactions. You know, we can think about engineering the reservoir. Can you make statements about what we should be measuring?
No. So I have been thinking about Lieb-Robinson bounds, but in context of completely something completely different. So we do work on quantum speed limits and that sort of things, and we've been thinking about Lieb-Robinson in that context, but I haven't thought about it in this context. So I think that would be quite interesting. So I guess the situation would be that you'd have some many-body state, and you set up, you imagine your system to be A and B, and then you ask at what time these two things become correlated. And you can write down a causal network for that. That seems like a natural setup.
Right.
Never thought about it, so thank you. We can talk about it.
Okay.
So I'm not sure that I understood you were saying that why are all carbon atoms the same? I mean, you're saying that, I mean, normally carbon atoms, I'm not sure now, are they bosons or fermions? Supposedly they're bosons, they would condense, you know, but the requirement is that I bring them into the same quantum state, even internally, you know, that they are indistinguishable. And then this non-Markovian aspect sort of comes in that I, as an experimentalist, prepare this thing to be in the same quantum state, but that's, so I'm not sure that I understand the meaning of the question.
So what I mean is that if I give you a carbon atom, provided it's a clean source, every carbon atom is going to behave the same.
No, it depends on the internal state. Okay, I mean, carbon atoms have internal nuclear spin states and all of that.
Yeah, I mean, within that state.
So they're actually different in that sense. And this is the.
I mean, so you have a probability distribution for getting a carbon atom in some internal state. That's a density matrix. But on average, that density matrix will always be the same. You'll always be sampling from the same density matrix. What it doesn't tell you, so suppose I have two sources. I get carbon monoxide on one side, carbon dioxide on other sides, and I extract carbon from that both of those by some process, and I give you them, and I ask you to differentiate between the two. You won't be able to do it after some time. That's what I'm trying to say.
Well,
carbon doesn't remember its own history.
Well, it will remember or it will not?
Sorry?
Are you saying that it will remember or it will not?
It does not. I mean, not for long, right?
No, I mean, if I have a chemical reaction or so, and then I get certain products, and of course there may be some coupling with the environment, so for a certain time it's...
For a certain time.
It will remember,
yeah.
And after a while it will be gone, but it's sort of the normal decoherence, coupled with the environment
sure.
problem.
Sure, but now imagine the situation where we have a isolated cold atom system, and we look at a subpart of it, and we ask, so it thermalizes, right, in the usual thermalization sense, equilibration, ETH, whatever you like.
But you talk about internal states or external states now?
I'm not really making a difference. I'm just saying that is this process, if I look at the dynamics of subpart of an isolated system, in what regime does it look Markovian? And how much work do I have to do in order to reveal that it is non-Markovian? That's the formal question. It's a very similar question to thermalization. You're asking a question, I have some big isolated gas system, and I look at a subpart of it and it looks equilibrated or thermalized after some time. I'm asking the question that suppose instead of just making one measurement, I make many measurements on it, can I now tell that it's different from something that has equilibrated?
So your framework is very, very general, and maybe it's actually a bit too general in the sense of what can I do with it? Now, if I think of the, say, dynamical maps, completely positive maps, if I add something like the sending group, I get useful master equations, say. Now, using your process tensor.
But master equations are very restrictive.
I'm just using that as an analogy.
Sure.
Analogy. So this, as you say, is a kind of super operator. Now, could I think of some additional condition of your process tensor that would then lead to something I can...
Stationarity.
Okay.
And this is what you do in classical setups as well. What you have is some process that is stationary, and once you have stationarity, you can then figure out what the central object is, and once you know that, then you're able to talk about multi-time correlations for long times from short time data.
And in terms of say a real quantum process, what would that, what kind of situation would that correspond to?
Take spin boson model, right? So now you can think of spin boson model as something that is a CPTP map acting on a system plus a memory over and over and over, right? And now, instead of dealing with this infinite dimensional environment, you might contract that into a finite dimensional tractable object, and you're able to think of it as a divisible semi-group process at system memory level, and that allows you to calculate all non-Markovian features at the system level. So it's effectively constructing a hidden Markov model. Okay. So stationarity is the generalization of semigroup, and it allows you to have non-Markovianity.
And have you written something?
Somewhere.
Okay.
It's somewhere in there.
Very good. Okay, well, Kevin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Um, so